Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs with 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Monday, the 15th of July. Coming up on the program, one of the founding directors of VBS reflects on the legal processes so far. Into the Government of National Unity Cabinet Lekgotla, what now in terms of priority? Why retirement for many is simply a luxury now, and how artificial intelligence is changing the game for WhatsApp. The presidency says everyone accountable in the looting of the now defunct VBS Mutual Bank should be held accountable. This week, former Venda Business Society Chair Chifidzwa Madodzi was sentenced to an effective 15 years in prison for his role in the fraud. Joining us on the program now is Madambi Mubulawa, who is founding director of the bank. And first up then, and welcome to you. This is no doubt a financial tragedy as far as South Africa is playing out. How are you watching it?
Well, as one of the founding directors, you know, when things goes wrong, it affects me, you know, and because when we established this company, which is VBS, it was with good intention that, you know, our poor people will benefit out of it at the end. But now it is not the case. So it pains me.
Do you feel betrayed by your colleagues?
Oh, for sure. For sure. I feel betrayed, yes, because, you know, we trusted that, you know, they will take the bank to a higher level. Instead, they collapsed it.
So we now see this plea deal, which is playing out. Are you satisfied with that direction, or do you think that people, particularly Mr. Matodzi, have got off lightly?
Well, we are happy that, to see that, you know, steps are being taken, and that the PHPA is also serious about it, as now they brought Mr. Matodzi into book and now sentenced him. Though we are not that happy with the sentence because we feel it's too low. We expected a harsher sentence.
So what, in your opinion, would have been a more reasonable sentence?
No, we don't have really anything in our minds, but 15 years, we never thought it would be the same. Because if you look at the amount that is that has been lost, and you compare with the 15 years, a person cannot accumulate that money in 15 years. So it's not comparable.
What is your comment about the implication as a result of this leaked memorandum of senior EFF members Floyd Shivambu and Julius Malema in this affair?
We are very disappointed, you know, because these politicians, we thought they've got the interest of the people that that they want them to vote for them, you know. And especially they are voted by poor people, especially these people mentioned there. And we thought, you know, they would be part of trying to make that these people who has lost money are refunded. But instead, we are surprised that they are also implicated.
So what action do you think now needs to be taken?
From our side, there's nothing we can do except to wait for those who are investigating, because the investigation is still carrying on. And but what will interest us much is to hear of a plan to recover the money so that some of the money can go back to these poor people who are now currently suffering because of this financial problem.
What kind of plan do you think would be best suited to do that?
Seeing that, you know, the Reserve Bank has appointed the liquidator, and which we thought the liquidator is responsible to the land bank. We thought the land bank would keep communication with us as shareholders, informing us of the progress being made But we are getting nothing, you see. We hear nothing. The last that we know we have been consulted, it was when we were paid 100,000 some years ago. And from there, nothing is happening.
Mr. Mubulawa, what conditions do you think existed in the bank at the time that allowed this type of fraud to be to take place?
You know, this happened. Look, I was part of the board. And according to the reports that the board were receiving from management, which were confirmed by auditors, it has looked like, you know, the bank is progressing very well because the reports were very clean and they were showing progress in the bank, not knowing that even amongst the auditors, there are also people who are compromised, you see. That's why you could not see it. That's why even the Reserve Bank, because the Reserve Bank also was monitoring this bank on a monthly basis. So we as board and the Reserve Bank could not see it the way, you know, it was planned.
Do you believe that you were either misled by the auditors, KPMG at the time, or was this just poor oversight and governance from the board of directors?
No, we were misled. We were misled because the board was acting on the information from the auditors, which we thought it was reliable information. That's why even the Reserve Bank was also misled because, as I say, every month the Reserve Bank monitored the bank and it found that everything was going well.
But it does raise questions broadly about oversight and governance and a huge failure in that respect.
Look, say you are in the board, you don't get involved with the day-to-day running of the bank, because that is the function of management. So because you are not there on a daily basis, you are not monitoring them on a daily, you appoint reliable auditors that would then confirm that what you are given is correct. So it is not oversight, really.
As a board member and looking back on the scandal with a degree of hindsight now, what would you have done differently?
I don't see there's anything that we could have done. Because, you know, if we could see in the report that something was going wrong, we would have acted by then without waiting. Mm. But nothing had shown that things are going wrong. As I'm telling you that we were relying on the reports which were confirmed by the auditors, not just, you know, reputable auditors, KPMG, who were recommended by the Reserve Bank, because as a bank, you don't just appoint auditors that could be a risk, you know, to the public. So they recommended KPMG. So we trusted KPMG that, you know, the report that they are giving, which is supporting the information that they are supplied by management, was correct. So we could have no reason to doubt that.
At any point, did you have any suspicions?
We never had any suspicions. Especially when we saw that the bank were growing. If you see, everything was growing. The bank was growing so fast. So we were excited that the bank was growing, according to the reports, not knowing what was happening behind us.
And just finally then, what do you say to the 20,000 creditors who to this day have been left high and dry?
No, as I say, you know, that has happened, but VBS, when it was put under curatorship, it was still solvent, which means that it had enough assets. If those assets could be turned into cash, so all those creditors, all those depositors could have got their money. Even now, the liquidator is still busy collecting money from the debtors of the bank. Some from the loans and all, the liquidator is collecting that money. And what we expect that at the end of the day, he will come back to the depositors and say, this is what I have collected, and then distribute it accordingly to the people who have lost money.
But it's taken a long time, hasn't it? Too long.
The problem is taking a long time. Everything is taking too long. As I say, even the investigation, we're worried that it's taking too long. Because if it didn't take too long, maybe they could have put hands on the assets of these people who have been suspected and then turn them into cash. So by now, you might find that they have hidden a lot of those assets. So those who don't expect that will get anything out of it.
Madambi Mubulawa, founding director at VBS Bank, thank you very much for joining me today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
All right, let's move on now on politics. And members of eight political parties attending a two-day Lekgotla to discuss the new government program. So for the cabinet, this really is where the rubber hits the road. And moving forward is going to be difficult, particularly when it comes to forging any form of unity and demonstrating progress. From the Wits School of Governance now, Dr. T.K. Puer joins us. And first of all, T.K., what then is the immediate priority, do you think?
I think they've kind of been saying it, and I think it's a positive one, which is to look at the economic cluster. Here we're looking at making sure that one, energy is taken care of, infrastructure in the form of Transnet and the like. And I think a firm commitment towards saying, listen, let's actually show the private sector and all other international investors that, look, we're going in the right direction. So I was glad in that. That's why you saw them rolling out people like the Minister of Trade and Industry and Competition. They made sure that energy came to the fore. Now, those that are not nuclear fans might not like what they've rolled forward, but I think that's the direction they seem to be in unison about. And it does speak to the fact that if you read all the manifestos, even those parties not in the Grand Coalition, everybody knows what the problem is. It's economic. Now, it's one thing to all agree on this. It's now the issue of, do you agree with the methodology? And I think that, as you say, that's where it's going to really be interesting.
Where do you think there might be conflict or disagreement on methodology?
Well, the key one will be, what do you do with state-owned entities, right? Certain parties, and I think the Democratic Alliance, when you read, I think it's page 32 of their manifesto, they are very quick to the draw to say, listen, you do have to privatize a lot of it. While this has been happening, I think, more by default under the ANC, now whether you make a firm commitment towards that and what that's going to look like, I think that's going to be a bit of a problematic thing. So the hope should be that, look, they actually rely on, I think, what President Cyril Ramaphosa is probably going to touch on in the State of the Nation, which is, let the evidence lead you. I think not all state-owned entities are bad, but there are some that do need to go. So hopefully the evidence and what you want to do in the future should lead you. But I think it's going to be a bit of a competition there. So that's one of the areas. Foreign policy, which I think was a bit understated. If anything, it looked like the new Minister of Foreign Affairs was being rolled out to media outlets and the like to kind of, you know, get used to it. But we all do know that's also going to come to a bit of a methodology problem. And it's going to be interesting to see again, how do they manage that?
I'm interested in the state-owned enterprises. And the fact is that we don't have a public enterprises ministry or minister anymore. Is that going to make things easier or complicate matters?
I think it'll make it easier because it's now being put under the presidency is one thing. And then there's also something which has been agreed upon, but I think it was a bit of a fight, which is to say, get those specific state-owned entities back to the line ministries. For instance, all the transport SOEs, yeah, you're speaking about Transnet and the like, and Prasa, get them back into their Ministry of Transport. Now, I think the key issue, regardless of whether we have a minister or not, is going to be, how do you sell it to entities like the unions? How do you sell it to them that, listen, you're going to privatize? And also, how do you also make it transparent? Because I think one of the key weaknesses of this government when it comes to state-owned entities, and it's something I always hang my hat on, is to say, I think there is value in a lot of them, but it's just the issue of poor management and leadership has basically put them at a junkyard type of status. So it's that balance of saying, how much do you say, listen, going forward and into a future economy, they're not important based on the fact that they may be redundant, and how much do you actually say, listen, government got them into this issue, and let's be specific, the ANC government, and how do you make that balance? And I think that's what's going to probably be a bit of a tough terrain for this government and, look, the government and a lot of these partners to figure out.
It's fair to say that there is a lot of impatience in South Africa right now, particularly within the business community. All very well to have the conversation and to try and move forward in one direction, but it's critical that this new government of national unity demonstrates some quick wins, particularly on the economic side. What, in your opinion, then, would constitute that?
Well, it's actually the article I'm trying to finalize at the moment. It's actually what you're touching on. And one of the things I think business and I think the rest of South Africans sort of have to get around is, look, we kind of have to be honest and say, we're not going to be swinging to the moon anytime soon. It's an issue of saying, can you just do the fundamentals? And the fundamentals has to be, Can we get, you know, a great a decision and movement, firm movement on energy? Can we get the ports working? And then thirdly, and it's something which could be coming out, is can we actually just all agree that local government, especially the majority of our municipalities, just actually need to be put under administration and be nursed back, and also, if not, maybe dissolve some. So the first two, I think, is doable, which is to say energy and transport. Let's get those right. And the third thing, if you really do want to, like you say, you start swinging and showing that, listen, there's some firm direction, is let's go for local government. But I think this is not going to happen at the pace many people expect, because this is not even to do with the coalition issue. It's just the fact that government has not historically in South Africa proved itself worthy. And I think we as South Africans kind of have to get used to saying, listen, we want minimal damage. If we can, if they cannot damage South Africa any much further, we should take that as a win. But on the key issues of infrastructure and transport and the like, we have to sit on their necks.
But it is all going to come down to operational process. And it's interesting to see that Bantu Halimisa again was talking about this technical committee to play some sort of brokerage role in identifying common interests from manifestos and also resolving conflict that stems from that.
It was interesting, but it's part of the things I'm making in my article is to say, look, every South African, you don't even need a PhD, every South African knows what the problems have been. If you look at all our reports over the last two decades, everybody knows what they are. The key issue has never been that we don't know what the problems are. The key issue is just make a political and a leadership decision to address them. I think that's the key issue. So what we don't need is more structures. We don't need more policies. What we need is to say, listen, pick three things which we all know are holding the economy back. And it's the one, as I've been harping on, it's the one about energy, transport, and the like. Pick those things and do them well, as in get in the experts that you need to get in, get investment from the private sector. And if you can do those ones, if you can just loose those things up in the next 3 years, I think it will actually make South Africa a better place. So no more structures, just fix what we all know is a problem. Get it done quickly, get in the private sector to get in their confidence into this. And then if you were to win these things in your short term, which is the 3 years, then I think South Africans will be a bit more optimistic. But for at the moment, I think we need to just simply be saying, listen, don't give us more policies, don't give us more institutions. Just fix what we all know to be the problems.
Next step is to read that article, I guess. TK Puer from the Wits School of Governance, thank you very much for joining me today. Appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
A significant number of South Africans under the age of 60 intend to continue working beyond the traditional retirement age. The 2024 FNB Retirement Insight Survey highlighting that economic pressures and insufficient financial literacy contribute to this lack of preparedness for retirement among many of us. I'm in conversation now with Becky Mkhize, who is Chief Executive Officer, Wealth and Investments at FNB. Welcome and thank you very much for joining us. Having looked at the survey, do you think that for many South Africans, retirement has now become a luxury?
Good afternoon, Jeremy, and good afternoon to the listeners. I think it's a combination of two things. One is probably lack of information, but then the some of the matters that you do mention are actually quite important in terms of people's ability to retire, where we see from the survey a lot of outcomes showing that people just don't have enough to be able to save and put money away for retirement.
And if that trajectory continues, and there's no reason to believe that things are going to improve dramatically, what it means is that more and more South Africans, I guess, become vulnerable.
Yes, that's correct. And the challenge there becomes that a lot of people then end up relying either on the state or dependent on their families, and where they're dependent on their families, it's normally a case of their kids, and normally those kids have their own children, so you end up with the sandwich generation where, and that comes through in our survey as well, where the children are looking after their parents, but they're also at the same time looking after their own children. So you never break that cycle of people having been extended by providing for their parents and their children if you don't deal with these outcomes. But I think these are also linked to macroeconomic factors and unemployment and that. So if we can get some of that stuff right, I think it will also improve some of the outcomes going forward. And then there are some good things that are on the horizons. I'll mention the two-pot retirement system as an example. We believe, you know, that over the long term will improve some of these outcomes because of the forced savings that people will have to make on the two-thirds of their money going forward.
That's an important point, providing, of course, people don't squander that initial withdrawal.
That's correct. So I think the initial withdrawal is limited. For those who actually do qualify, it will be limited to, as at 1 September, I think, limited to 30,000. And then going forward, people can access a third. But in our modeling and also looking at some of the industry stats, yes, there is concern about, you know, short-term liquidity in terms of if everyone withdraws early on, just the some of the one-third. But over time, definitely the two-thirds that people are compelled to preserve will lead to better outcomes in retirement for people. Because at the moment, with the system that we have, the majority of people, when they change jobs, actually cash out their retirement savings. So this will limit that, and I think it will lead to better outcomes. And then if you see where we rank relative to other countries in terms of retirement savings, we actually rank quite low. If you look at most of the countries that are above us, the reason is they have forced some kind of forced savings and have had for many years, where even if when you start a business and you've got employees, you are forced to set up some retirement scheme for those people and they cannot access some of that money. So I think we'll see some shifts going forward, but these will take a while, Jeremy. It's not going to happen anytime soon.
Do you have any thoughts on whether the retirement age should be pushed out a bit?
Look, that I think that debate, and companies are grappling with some of that debate, and it's linked to life expectancies, right? What you are seeing, and we've seen the same, I guess, in South Africa, where, you know, life expectancies globally has increased and improved. People are able to work a lot longer, just given, you know, the age that we live in, where you know, better access to medical care, better access to information and things around whatever exercise, etc. So I think that is something that is possibly on the cards. But what we're also seeing, and this came through in our survey as well, Jeremy, is that retirement is no longer like this date of I reach 60 as an example and I will retire. What's happening is people are actually transitioning into either new careers, taking up new income streams, and actually working longer. There was a very small portion of the people surveyed that actually said when I got to retirement, I actually stopped, because they're still economically active, and it talks to the point around the ability to live longer and having not saved enough, meaning that, you know, they're actually still economically active and they could go on for a few more years. So I think that debate globally is happening. But in a country like ours, it also becomes a case of, you know, because we have such a high unemployment, you know, how then do you get younger people into the work system if you keep pushing up the retirement age? Because at some point you almost also need to create space for some of the unemployed youth, graduates, etc. So it's a debate that's going on, and I think, yeah, it will be interesting to see where it lands. But the data around life expectancy and people living longer is also helping to force that debate into and the fact that we are seeing that people are working, are not getting to retirement and stopping, they're transitioning to other careers and continuing to earn income.
I am going to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed. Bekim Kize, Chief Executive Officer, Wealth and Investments at First National Bank.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, WhatsApp, says my next guest, is forging ahead with innovative AI features in its beta versions for Android, potentially outpacing the wider release of similar tools by tech giants like Google and Apple. Lindsay Shooters is the editor for ICT, Construction and Engineering and Energy and Mining at Biz Community, and joins me on the program now. And first of all, then, how do you see WhatsApp's innovative new features in these beta versions? Is it going to set it apart radically, I wonder, from competitors like Google and Apple?
It's doing it in a strange way, because of the install base, mostly. Because WhatsApp is used by like a billion people and everyone's getting the same features at the same time. Whereas Google and Apple are trying to like roll it out on the devices, on new devices that are coming out, and they need like specific hardware to do all these things, and with like subscriptions also attached to it in various capacities. So yes, it is a lot better in terms of their market rollout, and that's a differentiator.
So what advantage do you think it's, one, giving WhatsApp, and two, consumers, given its wide reach?
It is empowering teenagers to cheat on their homework.
Yes, that's the reason why they're spending all that money on one singular reason.
No, so from a Meta perspective, so from as a company perspective, they've been doing AI integrations for a long time in terms of like data sorting and like improving their own algorithms. So now that Zuckerberg has invested in this arsenal of H100 NVIDIA or graphics processors or hardware acceleration, he has a draw card for the best AI talent in the business to come and just develop various things. And what we're seeing now on the consumer facing side of like Meta AI being put into WhatsApp is just it's a byproduct of that. So they're just building cool things. And then Meta is just saying, cool, let's publish it and pushing out to the public.
And then that allows people to cheat on their homework. Lindsay, yes. explain to me, do users then of WhatsApp have an option of choosing different variants of artificial intelligence?
No, so it's all kind of baked into one product in the search bar. If you've used WhatsApp in a while, you'll see the little blue ring that changes shape. If you hit on there, you launch into a chat kind of experience, and it's like talking to a mate, but you can just ask it questions and ask it to create images and all those sorts of things. So, yeah, that's kind of how we're seeing it on our side.
Well, I'm glad you raised the images issue. So it's got this new feature of generating images. It's based on user photos. Where does the privacy debate fit into that?
So that would have been when you signed up to WhatsApp and interacting with the features. So you've given permission to all of that already. You are, I mean, that data exists on the platform. It's obviously end-to-end encrypted. But as you, as like a user, interacts with WhatsApp servers, that all got updated. There was a security policy update, a while ago when they rolled out Meta AI. There was a little checkbox that I think everybody just clicked without thinking. Yes, so but they don't really store all that kind of data. They just use it to generate the model. So like the other thing you have to understand is every time you make a request, that happens on a computer somewhere in Facebook servers or Meta servers. I mean, that costs a lot of money. So the less data they can store on that side, the better for them as well. Just brings down their costs. It averages out that way. So the cost is kind of a barrier to them just rampantly stealing all your data.
I understand the importance of introducing AI into this equation, but in any way is it going to detract in time over the core remit of WhatsApp, which is effective messaging?
It depends on how you look at it. It's more like a philosophical thing where I believe it's going to contribute to like the pandemic of loneliness that we are facing right now, where people will be chatting to chatbots instead of like actual friends and loved ones on this. And you will get certain personalities that will be drawn towards that and fall into deeper kind of cycles, whether that's psychological cycles that are maybe not positive. And as long as Meta can control that steering of those conversations, without encroaching on privacy, I think it will work out fine. But yes, it is complicating what used to be a chat app. I mean, I'm a parent of a 12-year-old, and she swears that she doesn't use it to complete her homework for her, but she also says that all her friends do. So I can't police that from my side without like ruining our relationship.
You've got to get over this homework issue, man. I can see it's troubling you. just a final one then. In this race, where does this leave Apple and Google?
Oh, this is Meta just kind of flexing its muscles right now at how far ahead it is on everything else, on everybody else. We're still waiting to see what Apple Intelligence actually entails. It hasn't come out in the iOS betas as of yet. And then they're also looking at different deals with different other AI service providers across the board. But I think Google has the most to lose here because they don't have a product that really fits into that category. They don't have a chat product. They don't have those. Like, if you don't have a chat product, then suddenly making your own emojis, AI-generated emojis, doesn't make sense for you. So, yeah, Google has a lot to catch up on. And then I'd say Apple is now in second place, and they'll show us what they have in September.
Mm. I'm just on WhatsApp at the moment, Lindsay, and I'm just saying to myself, what is the best way to do one's homework? I'll get the answer.
You have to give it the question.
Yeah. Okay, Lindsay Shooters, thank you very much indeed. I do appreciate your time from Biz Community. And before I leave you, just a quick look at our online poll today. We spoke a little earlier about the Cabinet Lekgotla and the Government of National Unity. The programs and priorities of government are going to be announced by President Ramaphosa at the State of the Nation, which takes place on Thursday. That's the 18th of July. In that respect, what do you think the short-term priorities of the GNU should be? The economy, crime and corruption, or state-owned enterprises? If you have a view on that, you can participate in the poll either on our X or LinkedIn platforms. That's also our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.